Internet historians, and in today's final episode of the season, we will be discussing the history behind the movie The King's Speech. England's Prince Albert must ascend to the throne as King George VI, but he has a speech impediment. Knowing that the country needs her husband to be able to communicate effectively, Elizabeth hires Lionel Logue, an Australian actor and speech therapist, to help him overcome his stammer. An extraordinary friendship develops between the two men as Logue uses unconventional means to teach the monarch how to speak with confidence. How'd you guys like the movie?
I liked it a lot.
I liked it. Yeah, same.
Samesies. I mean, I love Colin Firth. I love everything he does. So I was very excited to watch this movie.
Yeah. I think before watching it, I was under the impression it was going to be like a boring movie. But when I watched it, I was entertained and I don't know. I liked it.
Yeah. Okay. So, cause I was going to say, I remember when it came out, I was thinking that it was not a true story, that it was just some made up one and that was going to be super boring. And then that's why I put off watching it for so many years. And then when I finally watched it, I was like, oh my God, it's actually good.
Yeah. I think, well, one thing that I thought was not funny, well, yeah, I guess funny. Like, you know, the end, obviously the speech that he made at the end, I thought it was kind of funny how like it was such a serious speech, but after like the end of the speech, all of them were like, yeah, like cheering him on and shit or whatever. And then I don't know, I just thought it was funny because like they made it seem more like, I don't know, funny to me, especially when they're in there showing him how he was like recording or whatever, or the Logue dude was like, fuck, 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 or whatever, like whispering over the thing. And I was just like, oh my God, they're like, I feel like it was like almost like a mockery of it a little bit, but I was like, I don't know, it still was funny to me. And then after I was like, wait, I forgot that was supposed to be like a serious speech. And they were over there just like, I don't know, just, it was just funny to me, the whole setup and how people were like, congratulations, like you did it.
Yeah. You did it. Now we're starting another war. Woohoo!
Exactly.
I love how Helen is Queen Elizabeth and then in The Crown she's Princess Margaret. I'm like,
oh,
and
really?
Then did you know that I think her uncle dated Princess Margaret or like dated somebody in the royal family?
Really?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Margaret is
Queen Elizabeth II's sister.
Okay. Yeah, and then that's her daughter, right? And
yes. Daughter. Yes. Okay. Mhm.
I was like, too many freaking, it's like always every single time we have to talk about royal people, it's like God, it's like the freaking
all web. The same names, and then
gotta get
like,
the family tree out.
Yeah, seriously.
And then there's like the 8th and the 7th and the 6th and the 5th, and then
now when their names change when they become the king and queen. That's why I was confused too. I was like, wait, what? But
yeah.
Like you said, I feel like it was like surprisingly not as boring as I don't know. I mean, I don't know why it would come across as boring or like, I guess the subject matter, I'm not quite sure, but yeah, it was entertaining. Like JC actually sat down and watched the whole thing.
Well, he was in it. I'm like, what's it like to be married to a movie star?
Oh yeah. Yeah, but yeah, see, he also had the preconception that it was going to be boring. So I don't know why it seemed like it was going to be a boring movie, but it was entertaining. It was like you said, it was had its funny moments and yeah, so.
Okay, so let's start talking about King George VI. Sorry, I forgot which number he was. All right, well, I'm going to call him Bertie because he's actually Prince Albert, as we discussed. Fun fact, he was born on the day Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, died, and that's why they named him Albert. Mm-hmm. But the family calls him Bertie. Queen Mary was not happy about that, but you know, whatever, who cares? So what caused King George's the sixth stammer? Well, he didn't have like a stroke or something like that where they can like trace it back to a medical issue. A lot of it is speculated to be like psychological issues. And you think like a royal life, it's amazing with the gold and the glamour. But looking back at Bertie's life, it's not so glamorous at all. To me, it seemed like he was always in his brother's shadow. I'll call him David. He is known as King Edward VIII. So David's that charming, handsome dude. And Bertie's just like that one dude in the back. So in the movie, Bertie mentioned a nanny who would pinch him so he'd cry and have to go back to the nanny. And from what I researched, that's actually true. When the boys had to go back to the parents, the nanny would pinch, by boys, I mean Edward or David and Bertie, the nannies would pinch the boys so that they would cry so much so that the parents didn't want to deal with them and just send them back to the nannies. Fucked up, right?
But why would they do that?
Yeah, why would they do that?
They wanted the boys to go back to them? I'm confused.
I don't know why. I mean, I didn't look into like, why are you a fucked up nanny?
Yeah.
But they had fucked up nannies for a couple of years, and it's just because the king and queen, they weren't very involved in their children's lives, and this is just very common at the time of their royalty. And when it comes to like the type of people they're with, they're all like that. They just have their kids getting taken care of by nannies, and they would only see their kids like here and there. So that's why it took a couple of years for them to actually figure out that this nanny was mistreating the boys, and they did let her go. So it's not like they were like, oh, okay, whatever. They didn't let this nanny go, you know. And I read that it wasn't just like this physical abuse of pinching them. There was actually some emotional abuse as well. I don't know exactly what, but they said both emotional and physical abuse was by the hand of the nanny. And then in the movie, I think that Colin said that it was only him that was getting abused, but I read that it was both him and David who were getting abused. It just seems like they both just reacted differently. But to be fair, it looks like Bertie just had a lot more against him. So he was sick very often. He was left-handed and then forced to become a right-hand person. And then they described him as frightened easily. I think that just goes back to the trauma from the nanny. And he did have knock knees, so he had to wear splints. I'm like, is that it? What else?
Oh, what else?
Like, the list goes on and on.
Gosh.
So yeah, it's like, how did you come out okay? Honestly,
I mean, he didn't.
yeah, true. I mean, yeah. Able to be like not terrible, I guess. But so and then there's his parents, King George the Fifth and Queen Mary. King George is described as a harsh disciplinary but demonstratively affectionate. So it seems like he's like both sides of the spectrum kind of dad. Like he was really harsh, but also he like showed affection. So they did also say that King George did encourage the kids to kind of like make fun of Bertie for his stammer in hopes that this type of method would, I guess, stop him from stammering. It didn't. Queen Mary was very playful with her kids, even though in the public she seemed to be very strict. They didn't really have a relationship with their parents. You know, this is their parents, but the type of relationship I think we have with our parents isn't the type that they had with theirs, just because they had nannies basically raising them. Another thing I've noticed is that King George seemed to be a very, very harsh, I did say he's like a very harsh disciplinary father, but even more so because he had put so much pressure on the two boys primarily about the throne, the crown, I don't know what to call it. If we want to get into historical facts, like, you know, it was practically taken away from them, and you know, or like they literally had it. Like it was almost taken away from them. So King George is literally like grasping on with it. So that's why he was so strict with these boys. And so they have a ton of pressure on them, but they say that Edward and David with this type of treatment just both reacted completely differently towards it. Okay. I'm going to get into Edward/David. Sorry if I go back and forth between Edward and David. He's both, I guess, you know, I don't know. So David, the older brother, is the heir to the throne and later became King Edward the Eighth, and then not. So what happened?
And then not.
And then not.
He wasn't King Edward anymore. So David was that party boy. So that's what makes him so different, is that David just kept partying. And then Bertie, he fell in love and, you know, got married, settled down, had kids. And David was like, fuck that, I'm going to keep going. So then he meets Wallis Simpson. And as I mentioned in the movie, she is on her second marriage at the time. And then in that time, a divorce is a huge no-no, especially with the royal family, because they are head of the church. Like, I'm not really religious. I don't really know too much about that, but they were saying, you know, under the eyes of God, I guess, like who you marry is who you're supposed to be with the rest of your life. Unless that person dies, then you can remarry, but they just don't view divorce and that person still alive as like, and marrying that person. Okay. So if you're divorced and your significant other who you divorced from is still alive, like you're technically still married to them under the eyes of God. Does that make sense?
isn't Meghan Markle divorced?
Yes. I will get into that.
Okay.
I did put that in there. So anyways, they did not want the king to be marrying a divorcee because he is the head of church. So in America, like we say that the church and state are supposed to be separate, but in the UK, that it's like the prime minister is the head of state and then the queen is the head of church. So that's why for them, they're saying like, no, this is a huge no-no. So David wanted to marry Wallace so bad. And they were like, no, you can't. And he was like, okay, fine. Then I quit. So after a year of being king, he abdicated and named Bertie as king. So this is off topic, but as we said, Margaret, who is Queen Elizabeth II's sister, she wanted to marry a divorced man, but then they rejected that. She ended up getting married and then she got divorced. And it just kind of all blew up in their faces because like all of Queen Elizabeth's kids got in a divorce except for the last one. And then I wanted to mention Harry and Meghan because they kind of like put Harry and Meghan like David and Wallace. You know, David married an American who was divorced. Harry marries an American who was divorced. So that's why they kind of, you know, I think they make it more dramatic than it is, but it's because it's like history repeating itself.
Mm. And Harry gave up his title.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, like, honestly, down there on the line. So
yeah, I was like, honestly though, I respected David for doing what he did, even though like, I don't like the fact that his wife was like had ties with Hitler and all that shit. But I think him as a person though, and like what he was kind of like, what, just because this is like the standard or the tradition that we have doesn't mean I'm going to do it kind of a thing. And it's like, that's what I respect about him.
Well, but, I do not. I think that he should have just done what he was supposed to do and just be king. Oh my God. I don't think he needed to get married. I don't think he needed to produce an heir. Like he could have just, you know, I don't, you know, just been.
Well, he wanted to be with the person he loved.
But then why do you have to like marry them? Like you could just be with them.
He wanted to.
But I understand that. I just think that like he was born into this role, and I know that's unfair, you know, in a sense, because it's not something you choose. It's something you literally are just born into. And that does suck, but I don't think it was fair for him to put everything onto his younger brother like that. Cause his younger brother just had so much else planned in his life. And he was just like, well, I'm going to be selfish and choose to do this. So I'm going to put this duties onto your plate now.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think either of them wanted it. Both of the sons didn't really care for like the life that they were born in. And I think they even like some of the stuff I saw was saying that he was kind of like the black sheep in his family because of that. But I do understand what you're saying about like, because he was a black sheep, I feel like that made Albert more of someone who's wanting more to like people please in that sense. And he wants to be the like one to kind of live up to everyone's standards because like he's also has something wrong with, I don't know. It's just like,
I think
everything's like, kind of messed up about the whole roles anyways, in general. I think that's also what I've learned when I was looking into some of this shit. I was like, dude, it is messed up. And I was totally getting the Meghan and Harry vibes when I'm doing the research too. I was like, dude.
Yeah. I was gonna say, like, I think that you respect him for being independent, and then I disrespect him for putting it on someone else's plate. Yeah. So I think it's just two different topics, really.
Well, in the movie, didn't they even like, I don't remember who it was. I think it was like not the prime minister. I don't know. One of the politicians, didn't they even like suggest that he just like put her up in a house or something and like keep her as a mistress or something? Yeah. Which I was just like, how is that more respectable than marrying her? Like, what the heck?
Because it's not the official title, I guess. I don't know. Well, but I think it's all about like looks or whatever, or like appearances. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why if he would have married her, it would have not been keeping up with what they wanted the royal crown or whatever to like appear like or something, you know.
I was gonna say as well, I sometimes wonder if like divorce is kind of a faux pas for the royal family because of King Henry the whatever You know, the one who like would marry.
Beheaded everybody.
Yeah, yeah, beheaded all his wives.
And got everyone pregnant. That one?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So.
I got everyone pregnant and then killed them all?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, yeah.
What made me mad was that he then outlived Birdie. I'm like, how dare you? You don't deserve to outlive your younger brother by like 20 years.
But well, Birdie was more sickly though, wasn't he? Like just in general. I mean, yeah. He smoked, she right? Or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then again, also the stress and everything too of the job, I think also what kind of caused his demise.
Because he went through the war.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah. So we're going to talk about the relationship between Elizabeth and Albert. So his relationship with his wife seemed to be a good one, pretty much like as it was reflected in the film. Prince Albert was married to Elizabeth Bowes Lyon. They met before in childhood, but when they met as adults, Albert fell head over heels for her and visited her family home often. Albert was determined to marry her. He proposed to her twice, but she refused to marry him because she was afraid of marrying into the royal family, which I was like, I don't know, this is the part where I was like, this is reminding me of like Meghan and Harry. She was afraid never again to be free to think, speak, and act as I feel I really ought to. But obviously they did end up getting married eventually. And they wed on April 26, 1923. Albert's freedom in choosing Elizabeth, not a member of a royal family, though the daughter of a peer, was considered a gesture in favor of political modernization. Previously, princes were expected to marry princesses from other royal families. And I guess also there was something, basically there weren't even that many other princesses at the time for him to marry. So that's also kind of why they started like opening it up to letting people who weren't in the royal family to.
Yeah. For them that to wasn't like his cousin.
Yeah. And like also too, I think because something I was watching was saying that how like, yeah, basically the royal family has like a big say in who marries who, which is probably also why they didn't like that David was trying to marry some other girl, because again, it's not something that they really had got a chance to sink themselves into.
They kind of did that with Prince Charles and Diana, right? They were like, oh yeah, you should marry Diana, not Camilla, because Camilla's a hoe.
Yeah, exactly. That's so, like, all this stuff was like totally reminding me of each other, especially that like I won't be able to speak and think and all that stuff, because I feel like Diana, Princess Diana, was kind of like the same thing, and then what's currently going on with Meghan Markle and Harry or whatever. So I'm like, dude, all this stuff is just like, I don't know, just again, it was just showing me how toxic like that whole thing is, really.
I wanted to say that I saw, this is like a long time ago, not right now, but I saw that Birdie really liked Elizabeth's family because she came from like a really, really big family. Mm-hmm. And they all,
she was
really,
like nine,
yeah, they was like a huge family, and they all like were very, very family oriented, like loved each other, played with each other, you know, had this wonderful family bond, and he admired that because it was so different from his family. And that's why he really wanted to marry into that family. Because he wanted that. So that was the difference he wanted. And then we see in the movie too, how he treats, like he has a temper with everybody else except for his family. So he really wanted to be family oriented.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. And she was the first non-royal to be married to an English monarch in 400 years. Mm. Elizabeth was known for being kind of lighthearted and funny, and she did, I guess, you know, obviously the king, his dad, was like stern and serious, and she kind of just didn't let any of that get to her. She was trying to like maintain who she truly was, which was like, you know, I think it was reflected pretty good in the film how she kind of had like a little bit of a humor to her and was kind of, yeah, just there for her,
like witty,
yeah, and like, yeah, she had like a lot of charisma to her. So yeah, and she was also a good balance for Albert, because as we know, he was shy and quiet, and mainly because of his stammer. So she was kind of the person who was more like outgoing and whatnot. And overall, she was a pretty popular queen, and Hitler even described her as being the most dangerous woman in Europe because of her popularity, which I thought was pretty cool. Just and because she like went to a lot of the places. Well, I mean, like, hello, Hitler thinks you're the most dangerous woman, and he's like the freaking
psychotic
dude. But yeah, I guess she would like visit a lot of the places that there were a lot of air raids. And at first it was like not cool, because I guess when she went there, she was like obviously like very well dressed, and people started like kind of hating on her for that. So then she changed her appearance and kind of dressed more down when she was out visiting. But because of her visiting all these people, that's like why she was so popular, as kind of being seen amongst them. And I guess I didn't also know this, that they were also air raided with bombs or whatever.
What do you mean by they?
Elizabeth and Albert.
Oh, like they were in a place that was bombed?
Yeah, the palace or one of the freaking houses, I forget which one, was raided or whatever. And
I believe it.
Yeah. And I didn't know that.
I've never heard of it happening, but I believe it.
But anyway, she like stuck by her man though, even through all of that. And after the war, Albert's health declined and he passed away on February 6, 1952. Elizabeth had said to a friend that living without a beloved spouse never gets better. You just get better at it.
Mm.
I know. She was pretty torn up over it. She kind of moved away for a while to kind of, you know, grieve and mourn. And then once she was kind of not over it, but like was better, she finally went back and joined her daughter who was serving as queen to kind of support her and whatnot.
The whole family was torn apart because I heard Margaret had to be sedated because she was like wailing, or I don't know if sedated is the right word, but you know, I think she was given
at that time.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, yeah, they pretty much had to do that to Margaret because upset.
Yeah. That's brutal.
I mean, that just shows you like how loving and close as a family they were. The Queen Mother was well loved because I literally just watched, I think because Prince Philip's funeral like just happened over the weekend. So like I started watching a bunch of like royal family things on YouTube, and one of them was talking about the Queen Mother, and you know, like I said, she passed away and she was like 101, and they were saying
passed away in 2002.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dude. That's a long time. Mm-hmm. So anyways, it was the same year that Margaret passed away, and so Margaret had her funeral and everything. So when the Queen Mother passed away, they weren't sure how they wanted to go with the funeral because they just didn't think that people remembered her because she's kind of from a different generation and stuff like that. And they said that actually there was a really large crowd that showed up as well, like she was still very loved because even at an older age she was still like kind of doing some work, not a lot, but if she could make it to like an event she will. So even to the funeral, Margaret's funeral, she like needed help standing up, but she like really wanted to go to that. I mean, obviously, but I'm just saying like if she could attend some sort of public event, she loved her people as much as they loved her.
So Lionel George Logue was born in College Town, Adelaide, South Australia, the oldest of four children. As he mentions in the movie, his grandfather, Edward Logue, originally from Dublin in 1856, founded Logue's Brewery, a predecessor of the South Australian Brewing Company. He attended Prince Alfred College between 1889 and 1896. Unable to decide what to study, Logue came across Longfellow's The Song of Hiawatha. The poem's rhythm inspired Logue to put his interest in voices to good use. After leaving school at 16, he received elocution training from Edward Reeves. He worked for Reeves as a secretary and assistant teacher from 1902 while studying at the University of Adelaide's Elder Conservatorium. While working for Reeves, Logue began to give recitals of his own, for which he was praised for his clear, powerful voice. After his father died in November 1902, Logue set up his own practice as a teacher of elocution. By 1904, he had gained a good reputation and was receiving praise from the local newspapers. However, he decided to take a contract with an engineering firm westward in Western Australia, installing an electricity supply at a gold mine. His professional career began in Perth, where in addition to teaching elocution, acting, and public speaking, he put on plays and also founded a club for public speakers. In 1911, Logue and his wife set out on a tour of the world to study methods of public speaking. Later, he developed treatments for Australian First World War veterans who had shell shock-induced impaired speech, which he talks about in the movie. In addition to physical exercises, which helped with patients' breathing, Logue's distinctive therapy emphasized humor, patience, and superhuman sympathy. In 1924, Logue took his wife and three sons to England, seemingly for a holiday. Once there, he took jobs teaching elocution at schools around London. And in 1926, he opened a speech defect practice at 146 Harley Street. Logue used fees paid by wealthy clients to subsidize patients unable to pay. It was here that the Duke of York, the future King George VI, sought Logue's help. Logue became a founding fellow of the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists in 1944. So from everything that I was reading, there's like some historians who got big beef with this movie, and there's other historians that are just like, it's not that important to the plot of the movie, so you should let it go. Because I guess there were a couple instances of like creative liberties taken with like Churchill's relationship with David. I guess Churchill was very supportive of David's rise to the throne or whatever. I guess he really was behind David and not so much behind Bertie being king. But then others argue that Churchill was just a big believer in the monarchy in general and would have supported whoever was in that position and didn't really necessarily have anything to do with, you know, David or Bertie. And then I guess there's also beef with Bertie, or once he became king, I guess there were, forgetting what the position is called. It's not a chairman, because maybe it is. I don't know. He was in the movie and resigned. I can't remember what his position was. But I guess people say that he's not so great because he like signed some treaty with Hitler, I guess, to try to put off the war that didn't end up working. So people have issues with the fact that he like tried to work something out with Hitler. I don't know. Just that he tried to work something out with him or something like that, which is just like, I don't really, which people argue the other side, that they were coming off another war and all these people, it's just like, we don't want to get into another war. So obviously they're going to try to work stuff out, not try to, you know, get themselves, like a lot of people died in the first war. Like, come on now.
I was going to say, I think I don't know David, the specifics. I think David and Wallace tried to like, have like be on good terms with Hitler, so that like, because I think they were always continuously like, plotting to abdicate, and so they were like, well, we need to kind of still be in high rank somewhere. So I think they did, but I don't know. I don't really like.
Yeah,
I know that the
I read that even David had Nazi sympathies, and I'm just like, oh no.
But yeah, his wife, she was like had ties or something to Hitler. And there's like a picture I saw of all three of them standing like side by side. And that's why a lot of people didn't care for like him or his wife because of that as well.
But I think that the reason why we don't really know much information, because I read or I watched on YouTube somewhere that the royal family or like but I don't want to say it's the family, but whoever's like protecting them, like hid all the paperwork that like between Edward and, you know, any Nazi people. So yeah, it's essentially a conspiracy theory that like we're never going to really know the true extent of it, because the royal people hid it all and you can't find it. I mean, like, unless they ever release it. And I think, I guess they might have released like a little bit of it, but that's why we kind of know this information, but in the fullest extent we're never gonna know, because they're gonna hide it forever. It makes me think about all these those other like royal families we talk about, how like the queens and stuff, like, or they would write in their journal every single day when they died, their like freaking kids burned them, and I'm like, why? I wanted to know.
So. Oh, and then the other thing that people had issue with, not as much as those other things, which people are like, let it go, is like the timeline, which as per usual, stuff is condensed and rearranged, but it's just like, that's how movie making works. So it's kind of, so yeah, one of the things like I mentioned earlier was that they made it seem like Bertie really came to Logue once he became king, or you know, didn't really seek help until closer to when he became king, which wasn't true. He actually had been working with him for like years prior. Logue's grandson actually wrote a book on Lionel, which is where I got a lot of this info, which is, I think it's also called the King's Speech : some other stuff. And but I was just like, wow.
The unofficial biography. Nah.
Yeah, perhaps, so as I was saying, perhaps the biggest inaccuracy in the movie is that Logue was, in reality, able to help the king to overcome his stammer before the abdication crisis and his coronation rather than after these events. He first began to treat the second son of George V in the 1920s and continued to do so for many years. The movie shows that the treatment took place in the 1930s, and this was no doubt done for dramatic effect, but this is not strictly correct, which is what I said. Cooper's movie relates how George had been seeking help all his life for his stammer. He tried every technique and treatment available for the time, which is true. The 2010 motion picture does really capture the sense of desperation and anxiety that the future George had over his speech impediment. He's shown as going in desperation to the Australian Logue, and this is also correct. The therapist is shown as using innovative techniques to help George overcome his stammer, which is right. The Australian was an early pioneer in speech and language therapy, and he was an innovator. The film shows Jeffrey Rush trying to instill more confidence in the royal. He adopts several strategies, but none are showed to work. Eventually, he provokes the king, and in his anger, he can speak stutter-free. In reality, the speech and language therapist gave the monarch a series of daily vocal exercises, such as tongue twisters, that were designed to help him relax. This helped the future king relax, and this was key to the improvements in his speech. The motion picture does show that the treatment was not a total success, and the king continued to have a very slight stammer, which was indeed the case, and which we which you can hear in the recording that I felt bad for laughing at, but I was just like, oh, he still does kind of have like a
hey, well, in the movie he said that he had to let everyone know that it was actually him or whatever he said.
Yeah, exactly. However, the improvement in his speech was remarkable, which is accurately shown in the movie. Shows George having grave doubts about Logue and his treatment when he hears that he's not formally qualified as a therapist. In real life, this did not cause a crisis in the relationship between the British sovereign and the Australian therapist. Like they show in the movie, the Archbishop or something like that does like a deep dive or something, and it was like, geez.
In like a day, less than a day.
Yeah, like the deepest of background checks. It is correct that Logue was not formally qualified because there was no education system for language therapy when he was young, which I was like kind of thinking when I watched it. I'm like, I doubt there's even like a, like, yeah. How would he be qualified in this? It seems really specific, but who knows? Instead, he was self-taught and had traveled the world studying the ideas of respected speech therapists. The movie leaves the viewer in no doubt that the king and the royal family owed the Australian a great debt, and this was the case. And when George died, his widow, the queen, wrote to the therapist to thank him for all he had done for her husband. Which leads me to their relationship and how the screenwriters even got all this info. So I found this info from a LA Times article from 2011. Unlike they show in the movie, Birdie and Logue actually hit it off immediately. There wasn't really a question of like trust in Logue's methods or anything like that. They were friends. They got along really well. Logue wrote in a note later published in the King's official biography that Birdie left their first meeting brimming with confidence. After just 2 months of treatment, the Duke's improvement was significant enough for him to begin making successful royal tours with all the public speaking that entailed. George V, his father, was so delighted that Birdie rapidly became his favored son and preferred heir.
Ooh. Wow.
In interviews, the screenwriter, Seidler, has been ambiguous about what sources he consulted in writing the script. The various biographies of King George VI all tell of the king's relationship with Logue. This includes the official biography published in 1958. John Wheeler Bennett, the royal biographer, he was personally selected by the king's widow, was himself a former patient of Logue's, and so wrote about the episode with great emotion. It remains unclear, though, to what extent sources not available to scholars or the public played a role in the final shape of the film. Seidler has said that Logue's son offered 30 years ago to show him his father's notebooks, provided the king's widow agreed, but when Seidler wrote Queen Elizabeth, the queen mother, he was told that she found it too painful to remember the old anguish and begged that he wait until she passed away. Although the Queen Mother died in 2002, filmmakers said that they were provided with Logue's diaries, notes, and letters only shortly before filming began. Seidler has not specified how material from Logue's records was used, but he has said that research guided him to the conclusion that Logue's utilized Freud's talking cure approach. Thus, by reading up on the king's life, Seidler used what he terms informed imagination to create the film's therapy scenes, which I feel like is a good word or a good name for it. Informed imagination. Seidler also drew on personal experience. He himself stammered as a child, and it was this that led him to the interest in George VI. From what he has said about his own successful treatment, Seidler indicates that he projected that experience into his fabrication about Logue having to work patiently to gain Birdie's trust. This liberty with the truth certainly gives the film more dramatic interest. So I guess that's kind of why he made it seem like they had to work at it more than them just becoming fast friends. But I guess it kind of makes it more interesting because it's just like, if they just got along right off the bat, it'd be a really short movie. So going back to Loke's grandson's book, they remained friends until the early death of Bertie. The movie shows that Loke was present when George made important radio broadcasts to the British public. This was the case, but Loke continued to coach the king to speak in public for many years. In the movie, Loke is shown when Bertie pronounced that Britain was at war with Germany in September 1939 during a radio address to the nation. This is not correct, but the Australian did provide the king with notes on things where he should pause. For dramatic effect, where he should pause and breathe, and these were a real help in the most important speech the monarch ever made. Loke continued to coach the king for many years until about 1944. The therapist is shown as being very much at ease in the king's presence and treating him like any other client, which was not really the case. Despite their genuine friendship, Loke would have been expected to have been somewhat formal and respect the royal person of the king at all times. In real life, Loke was not as easygoing and familiar with Bertie as portrayed in the historical drama. So while they did get along, you still got to be profesh, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, so the little last bit on whether, so obviously, like I said before, I was kind of thought it was funny, a little humorous that like the biggest speech that he had was also kind of like, I don't know, how they were like, oh my God, yeah, you did it. And so that's why I just want to know, okay, was the final speech as big of a deal as it was in the movie? So yeah, I mean, it was a big deal because I mean, he was announcing they were going into a war. So yeah,
another war.
Yeah. So Albert gave his first big radio address on September 3rd, 1939, when he announced that England would be going to war against Germany. Knowing the significance of such an announcement, the king believed it was absolutely imperative that he give the best speech he could, with as few stutters and stammers as possible. A copy of the speech, now belonging to Lionel's grandson, Mark Loke, shows that Lionel and the king marked up a physical copy of the address for him to reference, highlighting places where he should consider pausing or swapping words for something easier to pronounce, as Alec just said. And it paid off. The king delivered the speech beautifully, and it's now considered one of his most iconic addresses. This speech helped him win over his people who previously felt he was incompetent, and he became a beloved leader until his death. Even though we think it's a little funny, I guess it worked for him because I think also that people were used to him kind of, you know, with that stammer. So I don't know if they didn't take him seriously. They just kind of didn't think he would be as strong of a leader as like previous ones. But I think after this, and I guess the like serious tone, I guess it had, they kind of, it won them over in some regard. And that, you know, he was a pretty, as they said, beloved leader.
It makes sense what you're saying, Nicole, because his dad was like such a strong leader. And then now that they're going to war, and if they have a king that's like stammering, can't even barely speak to his people, so, you know, going to this war, like how can they trust him in helping lead them in, or like be behind the people? So
I thought that was a good example when they showed Hitler making that speech and like how like aggressive and commanding he was. I thought, I mean, obviously not for whatever was going on in that propaganda, but like it was a good like juxtaposition of like how he needed to be and like how he like very much was not, type of a thing. But I was also going to say that in my research, I saw like this little blurb that I can't even remember who, I don't know if it was just like the general feeling or whatever, but there was just like this thought or whatever, thinking that like he wasn't, I guess not like competent, but like intelligent, I want to say.
Yeah, because he was like in his like naval class or whatever, he was at the bottom, the very bottom, but.
Yeah, so but yeah, they just thought that like the speech impediment, he just like wasn't.
Yeah. So. I mean, I can see that because I mean, I think people who do that are kind of, how he said, he's like shy and timid and kind of that. So I can see why you would want to even maybe be at the bottom, just so you're not like at the forefront, or people's eyes aren't always on, even though he's the king. So it's like,
well, I think for his entire
or not the king, but you know, he was prince.
Yeah, for his entire life, the spotlight was on David. You know, David's charming and handsome, and he's the better speaker. Like, he charmed the entire nation with with him being there. He also did a lot more public work. So people really knew him. And I think it's a hard act to follow, especially when you've been second best your like entire life.
One thing too that I saw, and it was like a quote or something like that, that I guess after, I don't know if it was this one or a different speech, honestly, I can't remember, but basically Logue like, I don't know, called him up or whatever the hell and was like, oh, I guess I can quit, you know, because he like did really well or whatever. And then Albert was kind of like, well, no, like the practice and like all that stuff is what was the most important thing. And that's where you're like the most vital. So like you need to stick around. I just thought that was kind of cute. So yeah, thanks for joining us this season on The Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts and give us a rating. And we would also love to connect with you. So make sure you subscribe on YouTube and follow us on Instagram. And yeah, we will see you next season for season 3 of The Internet Historian.
Woo woo! Bye!
Bye!